Chapter 18. Thereupon Philomena excused herself, that she might put a clean shirt on Jacobin, and Odo was left to his melancholy musings. His mind had of late run much on economic abuses, but what was any philandering with reform to this close contact with misery? It was as though white hungry faces had suddenly stared in at the windows of his brightly lit life. What did these people care for education, enlightenment, the religion of humanity? What they wanted was fodder for their cattle, a bit of meat on Sundays, and a faggot on the hearth. Philomena presently returned with her husband, but Jacobin had shrunk into a crippled, tremulous old man, who pulled a vague forelock at Odo without sign of recognition. Philomena, it was clear, was master at Pontus Sordo. For though Gaianazzo was a man grown, and did a man's work, he still danced to the tune of his mother's tongue. It was from her that Odo, shivering over the smoky hearth, gathered the details of their wretched state. Pontus Sordo being a part of the ducal domain, they had led in their old days an easier life than their neighbors. But the new taxes had stripped them as bare as a mulberry tree in June. How is a Christian to live, Excellency, with the salt tax doubled, so that the cows go dry for want of it, with half a zecchin on every pair of oxen, a stajo of wheat and two fowls to the parish, and not so much as a bite of grass allowed on the Duke's lands? In his late Highness's day the poor folk were allowed to graze their cattle on the borders of the chase, but now a man dare not pluck a handful of weeds there, or so much as pick up a fallen twig, though the deer may trample his young wheat, and feed off the patch of beans at his very door. They do say the Duchess has a kind heart, and gives away money to the townsfolk, but we country people who spend our lives raising fodder for her game never hear of her Highness, but when one of her gamekeepers comes down on us for poaching or stealing wood. Yes, by the saints, and it was her Highness who sent a neighbor's lad to the galleys last year for felling a tree in the chase. A good lad as ever dug furrow, but he lacked wood for a new plowshare, and how in God's name was he to plow his field without it? So she went on, like a torrent after the spring rains, but when he named Mamola she fell silent, and Gaianazzo, looking sideways, drummed with his heel on the floor. Odo glanced from one to the other. "Es she's dead, then?" he cried. Philomena opened deprecating palms. "See, can one tell, Excellency? It may be she is off with the gypsies." "The gypsies? How long since?" "Gaianazzo," cried his mother, as he stood glowering, "go see that the stable is locked, and his Excellency's horses bedded down." He slunk out, and she began to gather up the remains of Odo's meager supper. "But you must remember when this happened." "Holy Mother! It was the year we had frost in April, and lost our hatching for want of leaves. But as for that child of ingratitude, one day she was here, the next she was gone, clean gone, as a nut drops from the tree, and I that had given the blood of my veins to nourish her. Since then, God is my witness, we have had nothing but misfortune. The next year it was the weevils in the wheat, and so it goes." Odo was silent, seeing it was vain to press her. He fancied that the girl must have died of neglect perhaps, or ill usage, and that they feared to own it. His heart swelled, but not against them. They seemed to him no more accountable than cowed hunger-driven animals. He tossed impatiently on the hard bed Philomena had made up for him in the bailiff's parlor, and was afoot again with the first light. Stepping out into the farmyard he looked abroad over the flat gray face of the land. Around the keep, stretched the new plowed fields and the pollarded mulberry orchards. But these, with the clustered hovels of the village, formed a mere islet in the surrounding waste of marsh and woodland. The scene symbolized fitly enough of social conditions of the country. The overcrowded peasantry huddled on their scant patches of arable ground, while miles of barren land represented the feudal rights that hemmed them in on every side. Odo walked across the yard to the chapel. On the threshold he stumbled over a heap of mulberry shoots and a broken plowshare. Twilight held the place, But as he stood there, the frescoes started out in the slant of the sunrise like dead faces floating to the surface of a river. Dead faces, yes. Plaintive specters of his childish fears and longings, lost in the harsh daylight of experience. He had forgotten the very dreams they stood for. Lee flowed between, and only one voice reached across the torrent. It was that of St. Francis, lover of the poor. The morning was hot as Odo drove toward Pianura, and limping ahead of him in the midday glare, he presently saw the figure of a humpback man in a decent black dress and three-cornered hat. There was something familiar in the man's gait, and in the shape of his large head, poised on narrow stooping shoulders, and as the carriage drew abreast of him, Odo, leaning from the window, cried out, "Brutus, this must be Brutus." "Your Excellency has the advantage of me," said the hunchback, turning on him a thin face lit by the keen eyes that at once searched his childish soul. Odo met the rebuff with a smile. "D does that," said he, "prevent my suggesting that you might continue your way more comfortably in my carriage? The road is hot and moldy, and, as you see, I am in want of company." The pedestrian, who seemed unprepared for this affable rejoinder, had the sheepish air of a man whose rudeness has missed the mark. "Why, sir," said he, recovering himself, "comfort is all a matter of habit, and I dare say the jolting of your carriage might seem to me more unpleasant than the heat and dust of the road, to which necessity has long since accustomed me." "In that case," returned Odo with increasing amusement, "you will have the additional merit of sacrificing your pleasure to add to mine." The hunchback stared. "And what have you or yours ever done for me," he retorted, "that I should sacrifice to your pleasure even the wretched privilege of being dusted by the wheels of your coach?" "Why, that," replied Odo, "is a question I can scarce answer till you give me the opportunity of naming myself." "If you are indeed Carlo Gamba," he continued, "I am your old friend and companion Odo Valseca." The hunchback started. "Ti the Cavalier Valseca," he cried. "I had heard that you were expected." He stood gazing at Odo. "Our next duke," he muttered. Odo smiled. I had rather," he said, "that my past commended me than my future. It is more than doubtful if I am ever able to offer you a seat in the Duke's carriage, but Odo Valseca's is very much at your service." Gamba bowed with a kind of awkward dignity. I am grateful for a friend's kindness," he said, "but I do not ride in a nobleman's carriage." "There," returned Odo with perfect good humor, "you have had advantage of me, for I can no more escape doing so than you can escape spending your life in the company of an ill-tempered man." And courteously lifting his hat, he called to the postillion to drive on. The hunchback at this, flushing red, laid a hand on the carriage door. "Sir," said he, "I freely own myself in the wrong, but a smooth temper was not one of the blessings my unknown parents bequeathed to me, and I confess I had heard of you as one little concerned with your inferiors except as they might chance to serve your pleasure." It was Odo's turn to color. "Look," said he, "at the fallibility of rumor, for I had heard of you as something of a philosopher, and here I find you, not only taking a man's character on hearsay, but denying him the chance to prove you mistaken." "I deny it no longer," said Gamba, stepping into the coach, "but as to philosophy, the only claim I can make to it is that of being by birth a peripatetic." His dignity appeased, the hunchback proved himself a most engaging companion, and as the carriage lumbered slowly toward Pianura, he had time not only to recount his own history, but to satisfy Odo as to many points of the life awaiting him. Gamba, it appeared, owed his early schooling to a Jesuit priest who, visiting the foundling asylum, had been struck by the child's quickness, and had taken him home, and bred him to be a clerk. The priest's death left his charge adrift, with a smattering of scholarship above his station, and none to whom he could turn for protection. For a while he had lived, as he said, like a street cat, picking up a meal where he could, and sleeping in church porches, and under street arcades, till one of the duke's servants took pity on him, and he was suffered to hang about the palace, and earn his keep by doing the lackey's errands. The duke's attention having been called to him as a lad of parts, his highness had given him to the Marquess of Cerveno, in whose service he remained till shortly before that young nobleman's death. The hunchback passed hastily over this period, but his reticence was lit by the angry flash of his eyes. After the Marquess's death he had lived for a while from hand to mouth, copying music, writing poetry for weddings and funerals, doing pen and ink portraits at a scudo apiece, and putting his hand to any honest job that came his way. Count Tresker, who now and then showed a fitful recognition of the tie that was supposed to connect them, at length heard of the case to which he was come and offered him a trifling pension. This the hunchback refused, asking instead to be given some fixed employment. Tresker then obtained his appointment as assistant to the Duke's librarian, a good old priest engrossed in compiling the yearly history of Pianura from the ducal archives, and this post Gamba had now filled for 2 years. "It must," said Odo, "be one singularly congenial to you, if, as I have heard, you are of a studious habit. Though I suppose," he tentatively added, "the library is not likely to be rich in works of the new scientific and philosophic schools." His companion received this observation in silence, and after a moment Odo continued, "I have a motive in asking, since I have been somewhat deeply engaged in the study of these writers, and my dearest wish is to continue, while in Pianura, my examination of their theories, and if possible to become acquainted with any who share their views." He was not insensible of the risk of thus opening himself to a stranger, but the sense of peril made him the more eager to proclaim himself on the side of the cause he seemed to have deserted. Gamba turned as he spoke, and their eyes met in one of those revealing glances that lay the foundations of friendship. "I fear, Cavalier," said the hunchback with a smile, "that you will find both branches of investigation somewhat difficult to pursue in Pianura, for the church takes care that neither the philosophers nor their books shall gain a footing in our most Christian state. Indeed," he added, "not only must the library be free from heretical works, but the librarian clear of heretical leanings. And since you have honored me with your confidence, I will own that, the court having got wind of my supposed tendency to liberalism, I live in daily expectation of dismissal. For the moment they are content to keep their spies on me, but were it not for the protection of the good abate, my superior, I should long since have been turned out." "And why," asked Odo, "do you speak of the court and the church as one?" "Because, sir, in our virtuous duchy the terms are interchangeable. The duke is in fact so zealous a son of the church that if the latter showed any leniency to sinners the secular arm would promptly repair her negligence. His highness, as you may have heard, is ruled by his confessor, an adroit Dominican. The confessor, it is true, has two rivals, the Countess Belverde, a lady distinguished for her piety, and a German astrologer or alchemist, lately come to Pianura, and calling himself a descendant of the Egyptian priesthood, and an adept of the higher, or secret doctrines of Neoplatonism. These three, however, though ostensibly rivals for the Duke's favor, live on such good terms with one another that they are suspected of having entered into a secret partnership, while some regard them all as the emissaries of the Jesuits, who, since the suppression of the society, are known to have kept a footing in Pianura, as in most of the Italian states. As to the Duke, the death of the Marquess of Cerveno, the failing health of the little prince, and his own strange physical infirmities, have so preyed on his mind, that he is the victim of any who are unscrupulous enough to trade on the fears of a diseased imagination. His counselors, however divided in doctrine, have at least one end in common, and that is, to keep the light of reason out of the darkened chamber in which they have confined him. And with such a ruler and such principles of government, you may fancy that poor philosophy has not where to lay her head." "And the people?" Odo pursued. What of the fiscal administration? In some states where liberty of thought is forbidden, the material welfare of the subject is nevertheless considered. The hunchback shook his head. Aye, it may be so, said he, though I had thought the principle of moral tyranny must infect every branch of public administration. With us, at all events, where the church party rules, the privileges and exemptions of the clergy are the chief source of suffering, and the state of passive ignorance in which they have kept the people has bred in the latter a dull resignation that is the surest obstacle to reform. Oh, sir, he cried, his eyes darkening with emotion, if you could see, as I do, the blind brute misery on which all the magnificence of rank and all the refinements of luxury are built, you would feel, as you drive along this road, that with every turn of the wheels you are passing over the bodies of those who have toiled without ceasing, that you might ride in a gilt coach and have gone hungry, that you might feast in king's palaces. The touch of rhetoric in this adjuration did not discredit it with Odo, to whom the words were as caustic on an open wound. He turned to make some impulsive answer, but as he did, so he caught sight of the towers of Pianura rising above the orchards and market gardens of the suburbs. The sight started a new train of feeling, and Gamba, perceiving it, said quietly, "Colon, but this is no time to speak of such things." A moment later the carriage had passed under the great battlemented gates, with their Etruscan bas-reliefs, and the motto of the House of Valseca Humilita surmounted by the ducal escutcheon. Though the hour was close on noon, the streets were as animated as at the Angelus, and the carriage could hardly proceed for the crowd obstructing its passage. So unusual at that period was such a sight in one of the lesser Italian cities, that Odo turned to Gamba for an explanation. At the same moment a roar rose from the crowd, and the coach turning into the corso which led to the ducal palace, and the center of the town, Odo caught sight of a strange procession advancing from that direction. It was headed by a clerk, or usher with a black cap and staff, behind whom marched two barefoot friars, escorting between them a middle-aged man in the dress of an abbate, his hands bound behind him, and his head surmounted by a pasteboard mitre inscribed with the title, "A Destroyer of Female Chastity." This man, who was of a simple and decent aspect, was so dazed by the buffeting of the crowd, so spattered by the mud and filth hurled at him from a hundred taunting hands, and his countenance distorted by so piteous a look of animal fear, that he seemed more like a madman being haled to bedlam than a penitent making public amends for his offense. Are such failings always so severely punished in Pianura? Odo asked, turning ironically to Gamba as the mob and its victim passed out of sight. The hunchback smiled. "And not," said he, "if the offender be in a position to benefit by the admirable doctrines of probabilism, the direction of intention, or any one of the numerous expedients by which an indulgent church has smoothed the way of the sinner. But as God does not give the crop unless man sows the seed, so his ministers bestow grace only when the penitent has enriched the treasury. The fellow," he added, "is a man of some learning, and of a retired and orderly way of living, and the charge was brought against him by a jeweler and his wife, who owed him a sum of money, and are said to have chosen this way of evading payment. The priests are always glad to find a scapegoat of the sort, especially when there are murmurs against the private conduct of those in high." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.